The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
June 1, Rabbit, Rabbit, Rabbit Day, as we say in the Hewitt household. I hope you are off to a great start of June. Hope you had a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. Thanks to all of you who participated in yesterday's Semper Fi in America's fundraiser here on the Hugh Hewitt Show. You were generous, as you always have been, as you have been for 16 years on Memorial Day. Yesterday was a day for remembering those who have fallen in America's service. Flags are out. They should be out a lot. You know, I always believe the week before and the week during. Just leave that flag out there, and maybe every day. It's a wonderful thing, but especially on Memorial Day and especially on the week before and after. We have got a great show for you back. Those of you who are taking the week off, you can listen in. David Drucker will be along. Byron York. Ronna McDaniel, the chairwoman of the Republican National Committee, coming along. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. Then I mentioned to you, I was reading this book, Ridgeline. Michael Punky will be along today. All that ahead. A long weekend in the United States means not much news, but there was a lot of news overseas, primarily out of Israel, where it appears the change bloc has got maybe the 61 votes that they need to replace Benjamin Netanyahu after 12 years in power. We should know by the end of the day whether or not they can hammer out the final agreement. Lapid is the centrist who is in coalition with Bennett, the Yeshid Atid leader Yair Lapid and Yamina chief Naftali Bennett. Now, Bennett's pretty right-wing. He was chief of staff to Netanyahu for a while, but they've split over the years. He's a hard-right settlers advocate and will not do a separate state for Israel deal, and they've agreed to postpone that. It's just a bunch of people who want an Israel post-Netanyahu, and they have gotten together, and they say they have 61. And I'm going to spare you all the who Naftali Bennett is, the man who will be the next prime minister, because he and Lapid are going to sign a deal that will last for 5 years. That's how long a normal government lasts. They've had four interim governments. As Israeli elections have been deadlocked forever. And they would 2.5 years for Bennett as prime minister, 2.5 years for Lapid. Very few people think that this coalition would last because it is going to be dependent upon, first of all, hammering out a deal with the two right-wing parties, Bennett's Yamina and Gideon Saar's New Hope, and then the centrist party and the left-wing party, and then they're going to need Ra'am. Now, those other parties add up to 56 out of 61 votes needed, so they're five short. Guess who's got the five short? Or maybe it's 57 and they're four short. Ra'am. Ra'am is an Islamist party, like the Muslim Brotherhood, and some people are shocked that anyone would deal with him. But if you were going to deal with him in Israel, it would probably be best to deal with him with a hard right group like Nixon to China. But Ayelet Shaked met with Ra'am's leader, Mansour Abbas. Shaked is the number two in Yamina, and they're dealing with, and apparently at the last minute, the Ra'am guy wants a ministry or deputy ministry, and that will be a problem. Then even if they get this together and they write it all down, they give it to Israel's president, who is like the monarch in Great Britain, a ceremonial post. Their one job is to call in the government and dismiss the government. If they hand it over to the president, still the Knesset has a way of postponing it for a week to see if it falls apart under pressure. Because there are a whole bunch of Yamina voters and a whole bunch of New Hope voters that did not intend to bring in a center-left government. They certainly didn't bring in an Islamist party into the government. So we'll see. At the same time in the Middle East, Hezbollah's longtime tyrant, Hassan Nasrallah, has apparently gone into a coma, at least according to Ynet News. There are three English-language sources on Israeli and Middle East news. There is the Times of Israel, the Jerusalem Post, and Ynet News. So if you're interested in this stuff, and I think Israeli politics are the most interesting politics in the world because there are like 1,000 parties and they're always maneuvering, and then Netanyahu stands above them or did. The story at home is a sad one over the weekend. Crime, crime, and crime. Police are searching for a gunman in Miami who shot 21 people, left two dead on Saturday night. Actually, it was after midnight on Sunday outside of a music event in Miami. I had a friend have lunch with me on Friday who said, watch out for Miami this weekend. It's become the new place where violence happens. This reminded me of Huntington Beach for many years on 4th of July. Huntington Beach, California would always go crazy until all the local police forces came together and said, we're just going to stop it. And they arrested anything that moved in Huntington Beach for 3 years in a row, and it stopped the spiral into a kind of Bacchanalian violence probe, drunken craze that has now happened on Miami on Memorial Day, where people go for trouble. And this trouble left two people dead and 21 others injured, three of whom were hospitalized yesterday with critical injuries. No update. At the same time, there's a story in the Washington Post about a surge in violent crime in Atlanta. Now, if you're listening on 920, you know that Atlanta has become increasingly unsafe. This story is about Buckhead and Buckhead wanting to become its own city. I can't imagine that happening. I've stayed at the Buckhead. That's where I interviewed the Dalai Lama in 1995. So I got that going for me 25 years ago. And it's created a long career. Sit down with the very happy monk. We had a nice conversation. It's in the archive somewhere. But the Dalai Lama and I met in Buckhead, and Buckhead was swank and Tony. Apparently it still is swank and Tony, but it's got a lot of crime. Nothing, however, like Portland. Another Washington Post story from yesterday. Portland is a, quote, white city, overwhelmingly so. African Americans account for just 6% of the population. But black people are dying at near historic rates. And that happened again this weekend. And after months of social justice activism that made Portland a vivid, sometimes a violent focal point for a nation debating the same issues. It's just Antifa. I mean, it wasn't a debate. It was just a bunch of rogues. But that conflict between the police and the demonstrators gave rise to violent crime. And violent crime, while the police were busy not doing anything about Antifa, the criminals noticed, and so they've got that problem. Abroad, China is growing its population at the slowest rate in decades, so they have announced a new policy in China. You can have three kids. Now, I always like to point out the story within the story here is that the government of China tells you how many children you can have. Not a great idea for a government, but they said you can have three now because they look ahead and there's no one to put you in the sun in 25 years if you're President Xi. At the same time, the Wall Street Journal has a truly, truly chilling story. A smart lamp that watches kids when they study is a hit in China. That's not going to go over well in the United States. Britain's economic rebound is ahead of all of their former partners in Europe. Texas Democrats walked out even though the representatives of Texas wanted to tighten up voter integrity. And they tried to call it Jim Crow 2.0. We saw that worked out in Georgia and Florida. It doesn't work. Everybody's on to it. The new voting law in Texas would be more liberal than the Delaware voting law, but it will tighten up, make it easy to vote and hard to cheat. I heard that a lot when I was at the Republican Governor's Conference last week. This week, we find out whether the Supreme Court takes the Harvard case. Harvard's been discriminating against Asian Americans for a long time based upon, quote, diversity. Hopefully, the court will take that case. In Iran, we finally have some numbers. Nuclear fuel production plummeted after the mysterious explosion at Natanz. Way down. What did the Israelis do and when did they do it? We don't know. Kamala Harris gave the commencement speech at Annapolis. I have to play some of that for you. Boy, did she bomb. Then the New York Times has a story, 7 podcasts to soothe your back to normal anxiety. Are you anxious about actually living normal lives again? I'm not. I don't know who is. Must be millennials. The good news story of the weekend is there's an Alzheimer's drug out there. The bad news is the FDA is wondering whether or not to approve it. We haven't had a new Alzheimer's drug since 2003. This helps people at early stage onset. Yes, approve it. Let people make their own choices. And the happiest story of the day yesterday, proms are back. This is from the Financial Times. Proms are back as U.S. teenagers try to return to normal. There's never been anything normal about the prom, but I'm glad they're back. And I'm back. after a long weekend, a wonderful, wonderful Semper Fi Fun and America's Fun Show. Thank you all for joining us. I'll be right back. Stay tuned. That was The Rundown. This is The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America, on this Tuesday, the first day of June. I'm joined by David M. Drucker. You can follow him on Twitter at David M. Drucker. He's, of course, with the Washington Examiner. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Hugh.
David, I am curious about your last article about Val Demings in the Florida Senate race. You suggested that Democrats are somehow optimistic about this. I don't see it. Give me their best case scenario. Well, I think Marco Rubio's running away with this.
I suggested that they tell me they're optimistic.
Okay.
Look, I think when you approach a Senate race, even one where you have an uphill climb, if you're going to hold the majority or win the majority, you have to put as many seats in play as possible. So either you concede the game and don't play, or you recruit who you believe to be your best candidate and see what happens. And sometimes unpredictable things happen. So I agree with you. And I think Rubio is in a very good position for re-election. He has the Trump endorsement, which matters a lot, but matters a lot particularly in Florida, where Trump has decamped to, and his family is where most of his family now lives. He's the family that's politically active. So, what Democrats are trying to do is pressure him and put somebody forward that they think can take him on. Val Demings is a former police chief in Orlando. Geographically, she's in a good spot. She's got a good resume, particularly for where politics are right now. And having a police chief run when you have a period of rising crime and leftover civil unrest from last year as we get out of the pandemic is not bad. She's an African-American, and so she can appeal to different ethnic groups and energize the Democratic base, which means raising money and getting people out to vote. I still think, given Rubio's profile and given the politics of Florida, but particularly given the fact that there's a Democrat in the White House, and we know what historical trends are when that happens, that it's a very uphill climb for Democrats. But they like most of them really like the candidate they're coalescing behind. And some of them just believe that Rubio is a weak candidate, that he's sort of a mile wide and an inch deep. That's what they think. And so they think they may have, a shot at an upset here. I don't, but we will see.
Now, the interesting part about the Republican Governor's Conference that I went down to last week, they had a panel on states where their population is spiking with blue state exodus people. And Florida is one of them. Arizona is another one of them. Tennessee, of course, more than any other state, sees this surge. But these new people coming into Florida are not going to be Val Demings voters. They're fleeing California and New York taxes. They're trying to get the heck out of Illinois, where it's a punishing lifestyle. Connecticut people, the only people I know who moved to Florida personally this week left Connecticut, where the crushing tax rate was smothering them. So Florida was red, and it's getting deeper red, David.
Well, Florida is interesting, right, because the blue state exodus, which has been happening for actually quite a while, has seen a lot of independent and liberal-minded voters move into places like Texas and Arizona and Georgia and North Carolina and turn formerly pretty solidly red states into swing state battlegrounds, into purple states, is what we'd like to say. And we've seen the results in Texas, Democrats winning suburban, mostly white, but suburban House seats. We've seen what's happened in Arizona and Georgia last year with the presidential race. North Carolina has been competitive for quite a while, even though Republicans have been holding it since Obama won it in 2008. Florida is different. The exodus into Florida has been largely conservative and Republican, and you have so many Midwestern transplants in Florida. So Florida is like, it's multi-ethnic and multicultural. But a lot of the new voters that have been coming to Florida have been that sort of either ex-urban or suburban or conservative white working class voter that you found in the Midwest that Trump did so well with has also been moving to Florida. And in addition, moving to Florida from places like New York and Connecticut in some of these House districts that have shifted toward the Republicans. So Florida is just an interesting case all the way around for the kind of migrant other states that has landed there. And it's made the state still competitive, but at least for the moment, slightly tilted in the direction of the Republicans.
You know, David, this will take us 10 years to study, but it's my theory, my working theory, is that the Austin, Aspen, Boulder research triangle migration came first, and those were the lefties. Now come the people who are just getting the hell out of California, New York, Connecticut, and Illinois, and they're not going to bring with them their tax and spend policies that the first wave. The second wave is conservative. The first wave were liberals looking for lifestyle. And that's my theory. Very quickly, Val Demings would lose her congressional seat too, right? That's the reality, is that she was going to get wiped out.
Well, redistricting is coming. Florida's gaining some seats. Republicans control everything in Tallahassee, which means that I think some people are making calculations on whether to run for the House or not, whether to run seek higher office based on what they think is coming in that regard.
And I think she's one of the smart ones. Better to go out losing in a Senate race than losing in a House seat. David Drucker, always a pleasure. Follow him at David M. Drucker. Follow me. His colleague Byron York is next as we have our Tuesday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show continuing. Good morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. I almost updated my Twitter feed to say up next, Peter Tork. And, you know, that would have been a complete curveball to anyone not under the age of 55. But it's actually Byron York, not Peter Tork. Byron York, good morning. Happy June 1st to you. I hope you had a great Memorial Day weekend.
Big difference. Thank you, Hugh. Glad to be here.
Can you drum?
No. As a matter of fact, I can't.
Okay, well, then you're definitely not going to play Peter Tork on the revival of the Monkees. Although, with the Friends ratings, the ratings that they got for Friends, if they could get the Monkees back together again, I think they would actually have a winner on their hands. Do you agree?
Well, I think some of them are dead, Hugh, so I think...
Nesmith isn't dead. Mickey Dolenz isn't dead. Peter York isn't dead. Tork. Davy Jones is dead. David Jones is dead. You're right. Well, you can fill in. You can fill in.
You know, Byron, I never know what you're going to talk about. I mean, that's the, you know, sometimes I'll say to Dwayne, what are we going to talk about? He says, well, I don't know.
I don't know. Well, that just
occurred to me. And I just never do know. When I pick it up, I have no idea what we're going to talk
about. Well, we're going to talk about this. Let's play cut number 7 for Byron. He wrote about this. Let's give the audience a taste.
You are electrical engineers who will soon help convert solar and wind energy into power, convert solar and wind energy into combat power. And just ask any Marine today, would she rather carry 20 pounds of batteries or a rolled up solar panel? And I am positive she will tell you a solar panel, and so would he.
So, Byron, she laughed at her own joke. Very few, if any, others did. It was a bomb with a capital B, and the damage was widespread to her rhetorical reputation. What did you make of this fiasco?
Well, I did write about this, and the reason I wrote about it was that not because her joke bombed, although it did, it was because her speech really showed a vision for the role of America's armed forces. It was very different from what we've seen in previous administrations, and I compared it to the speech given the same place at the Naval Academy by the new vice president in 2017, Mike Pence, and also by Vice President Joe Biden in 2015. And they showed much different views of what the Navy and the Marines and a larger scale what American armed forces should do. The big headline, really, is that Vice President Harris talked about a military that deals with pandemics, hackers, and most of all, most especially, climate change. These are the modern enemies. These are our real modern enemies. And the idea that the Navy and Marines fight wars, and that the Navy are in ships on the nation's oceans, and they ensure freedom of travel on the seas. None of that stuff ever came up, nor did the heroic history of the Navy and the Marines. I mean, just none of it came up, and it was a speech mostly about climate change and how she, Kamala Harris, knows a number of people in the Navy because she lives at the Naval Observatory, and she travels on Marine One. It was really an amazingly tone-deaf speech.
Now, you know what I would love to know is her staff writing. Now, back in the day when Peter Robinson and Peggy Noonan and Tony Dolan and all sorts of people worked for the Vice President George W. Bush, H.W. Bush, and President Reagan, the writing staff would go over a speech and make sure it was appropriate. I'll bet you if we take a look at Vice President Harris's writing staff, you're not going to find anyone in the military. You could have made a speech out of the 10th Fleet. You mentioned cyber. She touched on cyber. The 10th Fleet is 14,000 strong, active and reserve duty sailors. They have counterparts in the Marines. Of course, they could talk at length about the intel and cyber worlds out there. But they could also talk about the South China Sea. They could talk about the threat to Taiwan. They could talk about anything, and it would be interesting. And you could tell some sea stories, and you can... But that was really a reflection of bad staffing. That's, you know, no one who gives an academy speech gets an excuse. They're not hard to do. They're actually easy to do because you've got a great audience in front of you.
You know, you talk about China. In 2015, when Vice President Biden gave his speech, commencement speech, at the Naval Academy, that was his big theme, was that the United States will have to place enormous numbers of naval resources in the Asia Pacific. He said 60% of U.S.'s naval forces will be stationed in the Asia Pacific by 2020. And he goes, P-8s, Zumwalt-class destroyers, littoral combat ships, forward-deployed Marines. I mean, he goes through a lot of the things that the Navy and the Marines actually do. And he quoted President Theodore Roosevelt saying a good Navy is not a provocation to war, it is the surest guarantee of peace. In other words, the peace through strength argument. It was kind of a classic discussion of U.S. military strategy. Vice President Pence talked about more about the sort of heroic history of the Navy and of the Marines, gave some examples. And, you know, in that stadium in Annapolis, Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium, on the upper decks, they have in huge letters the names of great battles that the Navy and the Marines have been involved in. So if you're standing there giving the speech, you're looking up and you see there's Coral Sea, there's Midway, Guadalcanal, Tarawa. I mean, there's just all of these great battles that the Navy and the Marines fought. And it kind of reminds you, you know, what the Navy and the Marines have done over the years. And she, you know, she mentioned absolutely none of that. And Pence did, and focused on one admiral. This was, remember, 2017. It was the 50th anniversary of his graduation in 1967. And who won the Medal of Honor, and it was kind of a classic military academy commencement speech, and that's certainly not what Vice President Harris delivered.
Now, I've got a friend, Harry Rhodes, who represents me and Lou Holtz and a bunch of others at the Washington Speakers Bureau. He told me a story about Lou Holtz going to play a football game. I think he was coaching South Carolina, and looking up at that stadium in Annapolis at all the battles and said, "Hey, fellas, this is going to be kind of tough." Because he's looking at all these American hero stories embedded in the names of things like Tarawa and Midway and thinking we're up against, they're going to fight above their weight. It is not hard to do. However, there's a reason that I don't think she called attention to it, Byron. The President Biden budget came out last week, and it is nowhere close to the 355 ships, much less the 450 ships that are proposed as the minimum and the maximum number of the size of the Navy. It cut 4 out of 8 ships scheduled to be delivered, including one of the new frigates, a couple other ships. It was a disaster for the Navy. He's spending trillions of dollars that are not appropriated, and they can't buy the 8 ships that the Trump budget wanted, and they can't expand the shipyards that the Shipyard Act would propose. I think she was actually caught between a rock and a hard place, but good writers can still write you out of that.
Well, there's no reason she couldn't have talked about the enormous heroism of the Navy and the Marines and what they do, which is fighting wars. Instead, it was solar panels, as you just heard. It was still more about climate change. It was breaking through thinner ice than in the past because of climate change. This was, in two ways, a classic Democratic speech. One, these are the kind of changes that recent Democratic administrations will make, which is to cut the military and increase social spending. That's absolutely no change at all. And this is the Biden reflexive desire to undo anything that Donald Trump did. And yesterday in his Memorial Day message, Trump, the former president, talked about increasing the size of the military and talked about increasing military spending. That's something that former President Trump is very proud of. So, of course, you got to do the opposite because Trump did A, you must do not A.
100% agree. And boy, they could have at least talked about the 10th Fleet, the Cyber Command. Byron York, always a pleasure. Have a good summer ahead of you. Follow him at Byron York. Turns out Peter Tork is dead. My rest in peace comments to him and David Jones. But Byron will step in. He can both lead and play drums. So we can get Dolan's and the other Mickey back. I can't remember him offhand. But we'll be right back, America. Byron York on Twitter at Byron York. Stay tuned. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no-money-down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Senator Tom Cotton from the great state of Arkansas. Good morning to you, Senator.
Good morning to you. It's good to be back on with you. Happy June.
Happy June, and I hope you had a blessed Memorial Day commemorating your fallen friends in arms over at Arlington, as I know you normally do. Senator, last week I talked to you about the Wuhan lab. I've got to come back to it because in the last week we've been treated to a number of stories, including this on the Washington Post headline, leading scientist says that without a full investigation of lab leak theory, the world will face COVID-26 and COVID-32. This is Baylor College of Medicine's Peter Hotez. Am I right that he is one of the people that found it easy to condemn you when you brought up the high likelihood that there was a lab leak over a year ago?
Oh, Hugh, I haven't tracked what he said in and out for a year. You may know that better than I, but I am glad to see that he and so many other scientists and liberal reporters have finally acknowledged the basic common sense of our point a year ago, which is that this virus didn't emerge from some rural village. It came from a city larger than New York, right down the street from a lab where they research these viruses. I mean, surely your common sense should dictate we should at least look into that possibility. And that's what we should have been doing from the very beginning. And that's what all these skeptics from the very beginning should have been acknowledging was at least a reasonable concern.
Well, I read one of his quotes from last year condemning, quote, QAnon and the Russians and the Murdoch media empire. And so I think to myself, when you're throwing those three things together, that is kind of a poker tell. Now, I don't want to indict or convict him of being a lab denier until I've done more research. But it does seem to me that people ought to pay a price if they were simply dismissive of this theory, and not only dismissive, downright obstructionist in its investigation last year.
Yeah, well, Hugh, if that's the case, and it should certainly reflect on someone who made such a silly comment, and it's also a reminder, too, that all of these supposedly neutral, scientific, nonpartisan so-called experts often harbor deep partisan antipathies towards their opponents and will present those views under the guise of neutral and nonpartisan scientific expertise.
Well, it is to me a endemic problem, is that, and I just spoke about this with Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel about debates. I did not know that the RNC has to set the rule for the 2024 presidential cycle. The debate rules have to be set before the end of this cycle. Did you know that, Senator?
I did not, Hugh. And the only observation I would have on that is that we should have people moderating those debates who are actually interested in presenting the views and the contrasts that Republican voters care about, as opposed to, for instance, back in 2012, I think it was George Stephanopoulos who infamously harbored endlessly on birth control pills, something that no Republican presidential primary candidate in 2012 had made an issue or that I don't think our voters were all that concerned about.
Well, it was news to me. Chairwoman McDaniel told me David Bossie is running the committee that is going to develop the rule set for the 2024 debate cycle. And I simply would not allow a mainstream media host. I would simply go find the Mary Catherine Hams, the Guy Bensons, yours truly, and dictate the panels and then invite networks to cover on a pool or to cover sequentially. I would not let them put a single host into the mix because they inevitably, and just tell me I'm crazy, they inevitably take the discussion towards Democratic talking points.
Yeah, there's a long pattern of that, Hugh, of letting the blue media moderate Republican debates, focusing not on what Republican voters would care about, like, say, immigration or surging crime or our military, as opposed to focusing on issues that they think will help the Democratic candidate in the general election.
I'll give you, for example, the Biden budget, and I wanted to get to this anyway, is nowhere approaching a 355-ship Navy, which is the minimum. Some of your colleagues like Jim Banks and other are calling for the 450-ship Navy. I don't know where you are, whether it's 355, 450, or somewhere in between. But I know you won't be supporting a budget that cuts four of the eight ships President Trump had scheduled for this year.
No, of course I won't, Hugh. And I think, again, Joe Biden's budget shows just how radical the Democrats have become. They have massive increases in spendings in welfare programs, massive tax increases. Yet they can't even find a few pennies rolling around the proverbial cushions of the federal government to build those ships, to maintain our armies in strength, to without question modernize our nuclear weapons. It goes to show the priorities that Joe Biden and these radical Democrats reflect for the country, and I don't think many Americans share those priorities.
It's sort of astonishing to me, Senator, that there is this vast new budget, a $6 trillion budget coming out, and it does not have a real increase for defense spending, which is given how much money we're spending. It wouldn't be hard to keep the hawks happy, right? Take eight ships to 12. It just wouldn't be that hard, but they insist on insulting us.
It wouldn't. And, Hugh, you know this last year, too. I mean, on multiple pieces of legislation we passed last year when there was a genuine emergency at the early stages of the coronavirus, I worked with like-minded colleagues such as Mike Gallagher to try to get funding for our defense industrial base, which was hit by the virus just as hard as consumer-facing businesses that we all know about. Yet the Democrats adamantly dug in their heels last year, not a dime for defense, and now, unfortunately, Joe Biden has carried that on even further.
So how does that budget proceed? Who gets – is it Roger Wicker who gets to bring the heat on the defense spending side, or does it go over to appropriations? What happens next on this budget?
So the budget goes to the Budget Committee, which is run, of course, by Bernie Sanders. I don't think you're going to get a very good hearing for more defense spending from Bernie. But ultimately, they've got to pass that budget if they want to try to use the fast-track reconciliation procedures this fall to pass another one of their multi-trillion-dollar tax and spend provisions. Now, it's also possible they'll realize this budget is so toxic they never even bring it up. If that's the case, then I'm sure a Republican senator will be happy to offer Joe Biden's budget as an amendment and see it voted down, as Barack Obama's budgets often were voted down 99 to nothing.
Now, Senator, they have to have
a budget in order to use reconciliation, which is the 50 senators. Two questions. Have anyone produced any evidence yet that either Senator Manchin or his other responsible Democratic colleagues have given one inch on the filibuster rules?
I have not seen that, and I would say that it goes beyond Joe Manchin. And Kyrsten Sinema. There are multiple Democrats who have reservations about it, in part because they realize that all of the radical proposals of the Democrats, like packing the Supreme Court or making Washington a state or nationalizing our election processes, are very unpopular. And if you didn't have the 60-vote threshold in place, literally every one of those Democrats would be the deciding vote on every bill every week.
Do you see the cheerleading that goes on in the media for a filibuster vote? It's kind of a constant drumbeat that the filibuster is failing, the momentum is growing, we've got to get the filibuster changed. And yet I don't see any evidence, zero, that anyone in the caucus who was against that has changed their mind.
Yeah, the cheerleading from the media on this is totally preposterous. It's out of all proportion to what people here in Arkansas care about. It's out of all proportion to what we deal on in the Senate. You know, as Gene Shaheen, a Democrat from New Hampshire, recently said, you know, the Senate's actually passed significant bills. We passed bipartisan legislation to deal with the surge in Asian American hate crimes. The Senate's on the verge of passing a major China-related bill. Shelley Moore Capito has been engaged in good faith, serious, substantive negotiations on an infrastructure bill. Whether you support those bills or oppose them on an individual basis, they do show that the Senate is able to work together in a bipartisan fashion to try to forge some compromise that helps advance our national goals.
Let's close with the Senate one, Senator. There is a move to try and get that a vote. It's a terrible bill. It's unconstitutional. It's a terrible bill. It would wrest from the states their constitutional authority over voting, like Texas, Florida, and Georgia are exercising. Does it have even a prayer of collecting 50 votes so that Vice President Harris could break it, even if there was a filibuster, a change of rules with a nuclear option?
No.
You know, it's not very fair to your friends on radio to use that one word answer, Senator.
not a prayer, Hugh. Again, the Senate Bill 1 is a radical proposal to nationalize our elections, to enforce on the country every bad technique that, say, California uses, like universal mail-out balloting and ballot harvesting, where activists can come and ask you to turn over your absentee ballot, or these so-called drop boxes that are just sitting out on the street corner unsecured. It also do things like require all election challenges, literally every election challenge in 50 states, to be heard in the courts in Washington, D.C. It would transform the Federal Election Commission from an evenly divided commission into a partisan commission with Joe Biden's commissioner there. What do you think they would do to the opposition party if they had that power? It's a radical bill, and it won't even get 50 votes whenever Joe Biden or whenever Chuck Schumer brings it up to vote, should he bring it up for a vote.
Okay, I get a bonus question because you gave me a one-word answer. Our alma mater has a case which may go to the Supreme Court this week. They will be reviewing Harvard's admissions policies if they accept the case. Do you hope that the Supreme Court grants cert?
I hope the Supreme Court grants cert, and I hope that they rule that Harvard has been violating the rights of students through its obvious racial quotas and affirmative action set aside. There's this seems to be this sense in Washington and elite opinion circles around the country that it's just okay once again for government to discriminate on the basis of race, just blatantly hand out government benefits or withhold government benefits based on skin color. Nothing is more contrary to the spirit of our Constitution, our Declaration, than that. And the Supreme Court needs to make it perfectly clear to all of these recalcitrant institutions.
Senator Cotton, on that note, thank you. It's a great pleasure to talk to you on this June 1. Have a great June. I'll talk to you next week.